Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It gives me great pleasure to welcome you to tonight's seminar in the series Work in Progress in the Social Studies. Tonight we are very happy to welcome Dr. Philip Chantar, who is lecturer in world music and ethnomusicology in the Mediterranean Institute. Dr. Philip Chantar has his BA degree from the University of Malta. He has his MA degree in music from the University of Durham and his PhD in ethnomusicology from Sheffield University, which is the third largest department of specializing in ethnomusicology in the United Kingdom, just after School of Oriental and African Studies. It is a new departure for us in the Work in Progress seminars to have a paper on ethnomusicology, and we very much look forward to it. There's a big debate in contemporary anthropology over the visual versus other forms of perception, and Johannes Fabian, the Dutch anthropologist, is famous for criticizing anthropology for privileging the visual. Now, there are a number of us who take exception to Johannes Fabian's critique of anthropology, who in fact feel that from the word, which we receive from our informants, all the way through to their tonality, their tone of voice, all the way through to their very silences and pauses, if you will, their caesuras, going on to music itself, our sense of the contours of the cultures we study really comes much closer to a musical or acoustic appreciation than to a visual one. So we do look forward to what Philip Chantar has to tell us about the music and meanings of the Libyan Maluf music. I don't know if I've got that translation, that pronunciation correct. This, as I said, will hopefully be the start of, we hope to see more seminars in the whole field of what I will arbitrarily call musical anthropology. So, Dr. Philip Chantar.
Most studies in world music show that musical listening, whether at a live performance or sitting on a sofa listening to a CD, does not happen in a vacuum, but it takes place within a context that encircles that same listening in several ways. In a major study featuring the life and career of the Egyptian singer Umm Kulthum, Danielson takes up Torino's metaphorical notion of context as a useful means to the understanding of listening. Torino's metaphor defines context as an ever-expanding series of concentric rings with pathways that cross and connect them. Applying this metaphor to listening, Danielson identifies experiences which, although they are immediate to the act of listening and therefore lie along the inner circles of Torino's metaphor, they connect to other experiences which, although located away from the center, are equally as important as those closer to the center. Among these immediate experiences, Danielson examines the pleasure gained from the aesthetic experience generated by the music. This occurs in association with other remote factors that may impact on the music that we happen to be listening to. On a more personal level, this context may also include real or imagined historical past and personal memories that are evoked by the music. The meanings that we construct from musical listening depend on the elements that make up the context in question and how the concentric rings within it link up with each other. In the Libyan Maluf musical tradition, the context which frames the hearing of this music among aficionados of the tradition includes narratives of past well-known sheikhs Maluf, masters of the Maluf tradition. Some of these narratives have been incorporated as part of the history underpinning the tradition. Others, although more personal and somewhat more nostalgic, are gradually finding their way into that history thanks to their widespread recognition amongst the aficionados, and to a certain extent, even among audiences attending festivals of Maalouf. These narratives, these accounts, which Maalouf aficionados often bring up in conversation, are part of the context to which they relate in order to enrich their listening of the Maalouf with significance. Examination of these narratives and the observations accompanying them lead us to understand how this relates to other aspects of the tradition. The word Maalouf. The word Maalouf literally means familiar, popular, well-known. It's got several meanings. This music refers to that kind of music brought to North Africa by Muslims and Jews escaping the Christian reconquest of Spain from the 12th to the 17th century. In Morocco, this musical genre is known as Andalusi, or Ala music. In Algeria, it is known as Garnati, that means it belongs to Granada. While in Libya, as in Tunisia, it is called Maalouf. The musical form used in Maalouf is that of the nauba. In short, and this is a very, very, very short definition, in short, we can define the nauba, or the nauba is essentially a song cycle characterized by unity of modes or melody type and diversity of rhythmic metric elements. The poetic content of a Libyan nauba may include different poetic forms, such as muashahat. These are Arabic classical forms, like muashahat, zajil, and so many other forms of classical Arabic poetry. The continuation of the Maalouf tradition in Libya was possible thanks to the commitment of dedicated sheikhs, masters of the tradition, who knew the tradition intimately and passed it on to others during performances in Zawiya. A Zawiya is a Sufi lodge, Sufism, it's a movement within Islam, privately at home, and sometimes even during extensive conversations in the middle of a market. These were artists who had sometimes contributed by adding their own text and melodies to the core repertoire claimed to be of Andalusian origin. Each sheikh had his own way of teaching by heart the text and melodies of Maalouf. Some sheikh could hardly read or write, but still they preserved and transmitted huge amounts of Maalouf texts and melodies, transmitting them mainly through performance and teaching. Certain masters of Maalouf are still remembered for their particular feats of expertise. For instance, some are still remembered for the quality of their voices, while others are remembered for their skill in matching new and adapted words to Maalouf melodies. The history of Maalouf in Libya mainly evolves around the lives and deeds of deceased eminent sheikhs. Its early phases are mostly speculative, while the more recent ones are somewhat overshadowed by narratives revolving around the lives of these masters of the tradition. Most of these narratives are anecdotes, with the figure of the sheikh as the protagonist. For some close to this tradition and other people, these accounts are the only history they have of the Libyan, of this Libyan musical tradition. Such narratives are transmitted orally from father to son and from sheikh to students. They are recounted to receptive audiences during state-sponsored festivals and retold to friends before and after a Maalouf session in Zawiya. These anecdotes are sometimes accompanied by and elaborated with personal memories expressed with a deep sense of nostalgia, the kind of nostalgia that embraces a past that will never return, but which should nevertheless be an inspiration for the present. In this sense, nostalgia becomes an essential and narrative function of language that orders events temporally. All this not only enriches the hearing of the Maalouf, but also consolidates the aura attributed to what the Libyans refer to as the Turat Kadim. Right. The Maalouf is sometimes referred to as Turat Kadim, which means old heritage. The present paper relies on accounts that were told to me by Sheikhs Maalouf, by aficionados who regularly participate in every Maalouf activity, both in Zawiya and outside, and by both amateur and professional researchers, some of whom are themselves involved in Maalouf performances. Some of my informants have also received Maalouf training under the tuition of sheikhs that will be mentioned also in this presentation or in this talk. These narratives arise from conversations which I have recorded since I began researching the Libyan Maalouf in June of 2002. The experiences included in this paper are only those of individuals intimately involved in the tradition. Therefore, the paper does not seek to make generalizations regarding broader listening experiences of the Maalouf in Libya. Before addressing my central theme, I shall briefly introduce the history and the music of the tradition. This will be followed by a description of present-day performance practices and their related socio-cultural context. The third section includes several narratives organized into two main areas. Narratives that are now parts of history and others that are more personal but which nevertheless carry with them a strong sense of nostalgia. The fourth section then sheds light on how the annual Tripoli-based festival of Maalouf contributes to augmenting the atmosphere of nostalgia accorded to these masters of the tradition, to these sheikhs. The advent of Maalouf in Libya is still a subject of speculation. The general opinion is that no one knows exactly how and to when this tradition reached the country. What has been written on the matter repeats what has been orally passed on from one generation to another, and consequently, what I was told during the interviews that I conducted in Libya. One speculation attributes the beginning of this art to the presence in Libya of the Izawiya Sufi Brotherhoods, associated with Sidi Muhammad bin Isa. The tradition has been maintained by this brotherhood since the arrival in Tripoli of Sheikh Muhammad Alam bin Ram al-Fazi in the mid-16th century. It was at this time that the first Izawiya Zawiya, the first Sufi lodge belonging to this Izawiya movement, known as the Zawiya al-Kabira, the Grand Zawiya, was founded in central Tripoli. Over the years, it was the Izawiya Brotherhoods that maintained the tradition of the Maalouf in Libya. Maalouf performances in Zawiya are only held among Izawiya confraternities. Qadariya and Erusiya Brotherhoods oppose performances of Maalouf in Zawiya because of the presence of secular elements in the text. Hence, some sheikhs affiliated to the Qadariya and Erusiya Brotherhoods describe the Maalouf to me as folk music, which it would be inappropriate to perform in a Zawiya. Basically, by folk music, they wanted to refer to secular music. Popular Libyan belief attributes the early traces of Maalouf text in Libya to the presence of the major Sufi poet Abu al-Hasan Ali ibn Abdullah al-Shushtari, who, according to popular legend, spent time in Libya during his journey to Egypt. In Libya, Malouf verses by Shushtari are sung a cappella and accompanied during funeral rites of Sufi sheikhs and followers. Another more popular and widespread speculation for this transmission asserts that the Malouf entered Libya along with the Andalusian refugees who entered the country from Tunisia in the 17th century. A considerable number of these refugees settled in Tripoli, Libya's capital, as their first stepping stone after Tunisia. This may partially explain why the Malouf tradition in Libya, although diffused in other parts of the country, such as Benghazi, Misurata, and Sabha, Libya has always served as a transit route between Tunisia and Egypt. Evidence of this musical cross-fertilization includes songs found in the Libyan Malouf that are similar, if not also identical, to songs of the Malouf, of the Tunisian Malouf. This has sometimes led some Arab music scholars to believe that the Libyan Malouf is entirely Tunisian. Whereas in North African countries, a Nauba gets its name from its maqam, the Nauba in Libya is named after the first line of the song. One of the aspects that distinguish the sheikh from the rest of the choir during performances of the Nauba is his exceptional knowledge of Malouf text. Since it is an oral tradition, the Malouf is mahfouz, that is, memorized, and is gradually taught by the sheikh to student in Zawiya, sometimes nowadays even with the aid of recording devices such as tape recordings. I would also like to say something about the title. In the context of the Libyan Malouf, as I said, the title of the Nauba gets its name from the first line of the poem. But it is not the same case, let's say, with the Malouf of Tunisia or with the Ala music of Morocco, because in these North African countries, they refer to a Nauba by the name of the maqam, by the name of the melodic mode. So in Morocco, for instance, there is a Nauba called Nauba Rast, because the Rast is the melodic mode. The melodic mode is the name of the maqam and the title of the Nauba, so it gets its name from the name of the maqam. Libyans distinguish between two styles of Malouf, namely the Malouf as Zawiya, sometimes it is also known as Malouf al-Taklidi, Malouf al-Taklidi, and the Malouf al-Lida. The word Ida means broadcasting. The first term, the Malouf al-Zawiya, refers to performances of Malouf in the traditional context of Zawiya and associated activities. The Malouf al-Lida refers to the modernized form of Malouf, which, among other things, includes instruments such as the violin, cello, double bass, along with other Arab instruments such as the darbuka, the kanun, which is a zither, and the lute, in Arabic is known as the oud. So here we find, let's say, a combination of Western, so in the Malouf al-Zawiya we find Arab instrumentation, whilst in the Malouf al-Lida we find Arab and Western instrumentation. As I said, the term Ida means broadcasting, a term that refers to the strong ties which this style has with the recording industry, and consequently with the with the recording industry. The restricted recording market of the Malouf consists predominantly of examples of the Malouf al-Lida, which is recorded in professional recording studios, and such performances are regularly featured on the Libyan radio and TV. In the Maluf al-Zawiya, a nauba would take half an hour and even more, depending on the sheikh and the general moods of the performance. Such performances, in addition to a male choir known as raddada, and a sheikh would also include traditional instrumentation, consisting of the darbuka, which is a single-headed drum, the bandir, a big frame drum, the gita, which is it's got a sound very similar to that of an oboe, and nakarat. The nakarat are small kettle drums. I would like to show you the first video clip. This is a performance of Maluf in the context of a Sufi lodge. So this is an example of Maluf al-Zawiya. Just an idea of the Maluf in the context of Zawiya. Zawiya performances are mostly popular during the Mawlids, the period during which the Muslims celebrate the birth of the Prophet. Throughout this period of celebrations, all the Zawiya, the plural of Zawiya of Tripoli, would be decorated with lights on the outside as a sign of celebrations. Many in Libya consider the Mawlid as the time of the year in which the art of Maluf, in its traditional form, in the context of Zawiya, is at its peak, due to its frequent performances of Maluf in Zawiya and in the streets of Tripoli, in the context of parades organized by the Sufi confraternities. The shared religious sentiment characteristic of these days attributes a sense of sacredness to Maluf performances, and by extension, to the Maluf itself. In Tripoli, the traditional Maluf is also employed in wedding celebrations. It is a tradition that on Laylat al-Dahla, the wedding night, normally falling on a Thursday, the groom is taken to the mosque where he takes part in a religious service. After the service, a procession made up of friends, relatives, and a hired traditional Maluf ensemble leads the young man to meet the brides who will be waiting for him together with relatives and guests. The procession moves slowly and takes the longest route, with more and more people joining in as it approaches the house. After their encounter and the reading of the Fatiha, the first chapter of the Quran, the bride and the groom, accompanied by their respective families, leave for the Zaffa, that is the wedding celebration, the proper wedding celebration. Here, the Maluf ensemble performs for about an hour, after which the musicians are paid for their services and leave. A Sheikh Maluf may have his own wedding ensemble that provides such wedding services when asked to do so. Occasionally, other singers, may relatives of friends of the bride or groom, will join in with the singing and drumming provided by the group. Knowledge of the repertoire and performing codes of the tradition are the only prerequisites for them to join in. At this stage, one must add that knowledge of the Maluf and experience in its performance is mostly gained through performances of the Maluf in the context of Sufism, in the context of Maluf al-Zawiya. young Maalouf aficionados joining one of the modern ensembles in Tripoli would already have gained knowledge of the Maalouf through their involvement in Zawiya performances. The first modern Libyan Maalouf ensemble was established in 1964 by the Libyan oud player and singer Hassan Arabi. In 1961, Arabi joined the Rashidiya Institute in Tunis, where he gained knowledge and underwent training in the contemporary performance of the Maalouf. Such training had a bearing on the innovative performing practices that he later introduced into the Libyan Maalouf tradition. By the end of 1963, he had been appointed head of the music section of the Libyan Broadcasting Center in Tripoli. Arabi brought together the singers working at the center and established a modern Maalouf ensemble that included also Western instruments such as the violin, the cello, the double bass, and obviously Arab instruments such as the darbuka and bandir and the other traditional instruments. Performance of the Nauba Maalouf, as innovated by Arabi, relied less on the call and response form, which was now being replaced by choral singing, because in the Maalouf as Zawiya we find this form, there's always the call of the sheikh and the response, the choral response of the choir or the raddada. In the context of the Maalouf, Maalouf al-Lida, the modern Maalouf, because of several pre-compositional processes, this form of the call and response was completely changed, and now the modern Nauba is completely choral. There are no calls and replies in this modern Nauba. As I said in the introduction, some of the narratives considered in this present paper are presented as history, while others come up as nostalgias. The following accounts seek to clarify elements of the tradition by examining, in a personal sense, what it really means when the Libyans refer to the Maalouf as Turat Qadim, old heritage. Various crucial elements emerged during the conversations that I had with my informants. These included the making of pastiche verses, imitation of pre-existing texts, the transformation of erotic into religious verses, the relationship between particular texts and occasions, notable feats of memorization, tensions between composed texts and authentic text, and issues regarding the influx of foreign text and melodies into the Libyan Maalouf. For musically proficient listeners acquainted with this art, with the art of Maalouf, the Libyan Maalouf may be seen as an aggregate of Tunisian, Turkish, and Egyptian influences. Discussion in this vein adduces geographical evidence such as the positioning of Libya between Tunisia and Egypt, and historical facts such as the colonization of Libya by the Turks. It also involves accounts and narrations of sheikhs having borrowed texts and melodies from colonizers and neighboring countries. For instance, Sheikh Jamal ad-Din al-Meiladi, who was born in 1881 and died in 1963, is known to have composed verses on Tunisian and Egyptian melodies, verses which eventually became part of the repertoire of the Libyan Maalouf, claimed to be of Andalusian origin. Sheikh Jamal ad-Din al-Meiladi worked as an administrator with the Turkish military in Tripoli. He was also a follower of the Qadariya Dervish Brotherhood, as is apparent in a Maalouf poem composed by him with the title Ya Jilyani Tawilu Maashtu, O Jilyani, As Long As I Live. Sheikh al-Meiladi wrote this poem in praise of Abdul Gader al-Jilyani, the founder of the Qadariya order, the Qadariya Sufi order. The melodic source of this poem was a Tunisian song, a popular Tunisian song, beginning with the words Azakh wa Alap, make fun and play. Sheikh al-Meiladi also composed Maalouf text based on Egyptian tunes. Other sheikhs are still remembered for their obsession to change secular Maalouf poems into sacred texts. Such poems are known as muwarradat, pastiche verses. One of the sheikh who was obsessed with this transformation of text was Sheikh Ali Amin Sayala. He was born in 1860. Sheikh Ali's plan was that of composing muwarradat, pastiche verses, for all the love poetry texts found in the Maalouf, changing them into texts in praise of the prophets. He also wished to add some of his own verses to existing verses, Maalouf verses, praising the prophets, as he did to a Maalouf text starting with the words Ya Muhammad. In Maqam Rast and Ika, it's a rhythmic mode, Ika Musaddar. However, he was stopped from composing more muwarradat by Sheikh Muhammad Abdus Salam al-Faturi al-Mizrati, who ordered him to stop fiddling with the text of Maalouf and in due humility, Sheikh Ali accepted al-Mizrati advice and stop changing secular text into sacred text. Historical accounts of the Libyan Maluf tell of sheikhs preserving the authentic repertory and ironically contributing to the continuity of this tradition by composing and adding their own verses and melodies. In many cases, however, the inclusion of the new was seen by some sheikhs as liable to distract attention from the old. So innovation was sometimes viewed as a threat to the tradition, something that had to be opposed and possibly stopped. The context of contemporary listening sometimes includes narratives that deal with conflicts between innovation and conformity. The lives of two brothers, Sheikh Jamal Muhammad and Sheikh Kamel Muhammad al-Ghadi, are sometimes mentioned as examples of this particular tension between innovation and conformity. Sheikh Jamal Muhammad al-Ghadi, who was born in Tripoli in 1903, was known for his extensive memory of text. He taught a great deal of Maluf text to students in Zawiya and at home. He used to send unknown Maluf text, which only he had knowledge of, to a committee established by the Libyan Ministry of Culture in 1964 to compile and make recordings of the Libyan Maluf, because the Libyan government or the Ministry of Culture thought that this musical tradition was on the verge of extinction. However, they set up a committee to preserve the tradition. This was in 1964. The committee, which was composed of several sheikhs Maluf, used to meet three times a week under the chairmanship of Hassan Arabi, the leader of this orchestra, of this Maluf orchestra. While Sheikh Jamal Muhammad al-Ghadi was always ready to teach authentic texts and to share it with others, he rejected what he saw as the dangerous attitudes of some sheikhs in adding their own verses to the Maluf. There is a story about Sheikh Jamal that one day some of his students brought him Maluf poems which they had been taught by his brother. His brother was Sheikh Kamel al-Ghadi. He looked at these texts, he looked at the poems, and told to the students, go and ask my brother. If these poems are composed by him, then tell him to look for other places to make them popular. But if they are old texts, if they belong to the Turat Kadim, bring them to us to learn and make these poems known to the people. Sheikh Kamel Muhammad al-Ghadi, Jamal's brother, is still remembered for his Muwarradat, for his pastiche verses. Some Maluf Muwarradat composed by Sheikh Kamel have been attributed to another well-known Libyan Sheikh Maluf by the name of Sheikh Muhammad Abu Medyan. In order to avert criticism, Sheikh Kamel preferred not to claim these works as his own. He used to show his verses to Sheikh Omar al-Arabi al-Zanzuri, a scholar of language and religion, for checking so as to avoid falling into language errors or anything that could be considered abuse of religion. Part of the aesthetic experience of the Maluf lies in the beauty of its text. Skilled performance is seen as being dependent on verses that are fine in construction, pleasant in words and meanings, and enriched in beauty by elegant melodies. In this context, the new is only considered acceptable within the old if it fits properly within it and maintains its identity. The military march-like melodies of certain naubat, plural of nauba, have led some Libyan Maluf specialists to attribute these melodies to Turkish military music. Some of these melodies suggest sources of proficient music making, quite similar to the music performed in the streets of Tripoli during the Turkish occupation, military music basically. The inclusion of Turkish melodies in the Libyan Maluf brings us to the figure of Sheikh Eddur Efendi, a composer known for his inclusion of Turkish melodies. He was a prominent master of Maluf who served as imam with the Turkish military or with the Turkish army in Tripoli. Narratives related to this sheikh refer to the fact that he was also married to a Turkish woman. This is sometimes said to emphasize the close links that the sheikh had with Turkish culture and that he was exposed to its assimilation. Sheikh Gaddur Efendi used to take his annual leave in the month of the Mawlids, during which period the followers of the Zawiya al-Kabira, this is one of the Zawiya, one of the Sufi lodges in the Medina, because in the Medina, in the city, in Tripoli's old city, there are three Sufi Zawiyas. There is Zawiya al-Kabira, there is also another Zawiya called Zawiya al-Zaira, and another Zawiya called Zawiya Mukni. Sheikh Gaddur, as I said, used to take his annual leave in the month of the Mawlid, during which period the followers of the Zawiya al-Kabira always prepared a residence, known as in Arabic as Waqf, close to the mosque to be occupied by the Sheikh and his family. It is said that one evening when Sheikh Gaddur attended the evening's Maluf session, he said to those around him, "I didn't come to have your tea." A reference to his commitment to passing on the tradition and being of service to the Zawiya, rather than just having a good time at its expense. Stories related to these sheikhs are several, with some of them emphasizing the memory requirements of this art. Certain sheikhs are still remembered for the huge quantities of Maluf texts that they possessed. Maluf text in Libya is considered as infinite, so much that the Libyans have a popular saying, "Al-Maluf kelm andek wa miya antayrik." It means that the Maluf, a word belongs to you, while 100 words belong to your neighbor. Such sayings highlight the huge repertoire of poetic material in the tradition. One anecdote relays the story of Sheikh Khalifa Ibn Muhammad Farhat al-Rammash, born in about 1893. According to informants, he was fond of collecting texts and had them written down on several paper and notebooks. Once, Sheikh Khalifa al-Rammash met Sheikh Hasan al-Kami in a cattle market. Sheikh al-Kami greeted him and asked Sheikh Khalifa for some Maluf poems that might be new to him. Sheikh Khalifa spent hours and hours reciting poem after poem until there was no one left in the market. The relationship between music and event is also discussed, in parts offering historical snapshots but also summoning up personal nostalgias. Attending wedding processions and talking to informants between one Nauba and another, one may chance upon mention of Sheikh Ali Hanka, who was born in 1865 and died in 1959. He is mainly remembered because he was the first Sheikh to have composed Maluf verses in honor of the prophets for inclusion in Maluf wedding parades or wedding processions. Other stories that link particular texts with specific events may be more personal and therefore more nostalgic. For instance, Al-Shushtari verses, sung unaccompanied during funeral rites, brought to Hasan Arabi's mind the vision of Sheikh Khalifa al-Rammash on his deathbed, the day before he died. When Arabi was visiting him at the hospital, the Shaykh turned to him and said, "Tomorrow, Hassan, the funeral will be in the afternoon. I want a Shushtri poem." Arabi answered that he, that is the Shaykh, was still needed and wished him to be well again. But the old man's words were right, because he died the day after, and he was buried accompanied by Shushtri Maluf verses. The above accounts are indicative of how the listening context may also embrace other aspects. The image of the Shaykh, for instance, intermingles with high value attributed to the Maluf text and concepts of aesthetics and sacredness regulating its composition. Such narratives also exemplify the idea of infinity ascribed to text, and the myths of Shaykhs with exceptional memories act in support of this idea. As an additional observation, one can say that history is made of individuals, and, as the following section shows, these are brought to the fore and made public through processes of nostalgia. As from summer of 2002, the splendid gardens of Al-Markaza Al-Kawmiya Al-Markaziya Central Tripoli became the venue for the annual festival of Maluf. The aim of the festival is to generate greater interest in the tradition of Maluf through performances of both Maluf al-Zawiya and Maluf al-Lida. The festival includes both competitive and participative sessions. While competitive sessions involve traditional groups, traditional ensembles performing Maluf al-Zawiya, judged by a jury panel of active Libyan sheikhs, participative sessions involve Maluf al-Lida ensembles. Each edition of the festival is dedicated to a particular sheikh. Posters announcing the festival, featuring a prominent picture of the sheikh in question, are placed at traffic intersections all around Tripoli. Throughout the period of the festival, a portrait of the sheikh dominates one side of the huge stage on which the performances take place. Information regarding the life of the sheikh comprises a large part of the prepared scripts of the festival compers. Relatives of the sheikh to whom that year's festival is dedicated attend the festival and take prominent seats. They are interviewed and tasked to share with the audience their memories of the sheikh. The main content of these interviews focuses on the sheikh's commitment to teaching the Maluf, leading Maluf performances, and to living a good and observant Islamic life. For these sheikhs, the Maluf was not just an aesthetic experience. More than that, it was an intense component that enriched their identities as Muslims. Each traditional ensemble bears the name of a particular sheikh. The name of the ensemble may have originated either because the ensemble sheikh was taught by the sheikh after whom it is named, or because a son or other relative of the sheikh is a member of the ensemble, or because the sheikh himself was once the leader of the ensemble. All three possibilities embody a powerful element of nostalgia, which is consolidated by the framed picture of the sheikh normally placed on stage by relatives in front of the group that bears his name. As the ensemble assembles on stage, the presenter reads a biographical outline of the sheikh after whom the group is named. This may include anecdotes associated with the sheikh in question. So the evenings of the festival commence with a traditional ensemble that begins its performance with instrumental music, followed by a qasida or a muwashshakh. Then, for the performance of the nauba, the ensemble will change its positioning to match that seen in a zawiya. The bandir players, headed by the gita, sheikh and kinji, the kinji is the sheikh assistant, are grouped on one side of the stage, while the raddada, the members of the choir, sit on the other side. It is during these evenings that modes of interpretation, vocal timbres, such as when the people describe the voice of a sheikh as mistraiha, unstrained, and the way the leading sheikh selects the songs for the nauba, reveal with whom that particular sheikh had trained in the art of maluf. Music generates the evocation of images through sounds, and the maluf is no exception to this. The publicly pronounced nostalgias, the framed portrait on stage, and the vocal inflections evoking the styles of particularly well-known sheikhs emerge in dissonance with the sophisticated sound systems, the high-tech TV cameras chasing for the best shots, and the sounds engineer striving for the best sound quality. These moments of nostalgia are somewhat curtailed by the sound of violins, cello, and double bass tuning up for the evening's next session. The mood changes when a modern ensemble takes the stage. The frame picture of the sheikh is removed and the microphones are shifted to provide for a different ensemble setup and consequently a different sound aesthetic. The modern orchestras of Maluf are not named after sheikhs, but are known by the kind of music in which they specialize. The listening context which I have described, or particular components within it, may be replaced by the experience of having heard the Maluf on tapes, and as transmitted regularly on Libyan radio and satellite TV, rather than being constructed on the images of sheikhs and their notable deeds. It seems that in these performances, nostalgia appears even more strongly, not despite, but as a direct result of the markedly modern means that present and provoke it. Nostalgia, and therefore all the narrative that it holds, arises in importance as a cultural practice when culture itself takes on the power of distance. This is a process that is regularly present in the musical experience, and as a result, it is useful for us to consider music a context. Music sometimes should be considered as a context in which other events happen, and without which they cannot. My argument suggests that notions of the past may be embodied within shared listening contexts and through musical events that confront the nostalgic with the contemporary. Although reworked in different contexts, notions of the past and the nostalgia that accompanies them and even generates them are understood by many aficionados of the Libyan Maluf as powerful elements in the history of this musical tradition, and therefore as crucial determinants in their experience of this musical tradition as Turat Kadim. These aficionados are united as members of an imagined world of taste and practice. Modern practices in performance of the Maluf Elida give a face value impression of a serious lack of continuity, not just with the ancient past of the tradition, but also with the past, which, although not so ancient, is enriched by a strong sense of nostalgia. This brings the modern Maluf style into a kind of tension with the aura of the traditional Kadim, most associated with the Maluf as Zawiya. Such tension will be resolved through processes which in time will transform the present into a less speculative past. This may lead towards a more highly valued, because less speculative, type of history, enriched with nostalgia of living sheikhs, for whom the art of Maluf is a fundamental aspect of their identity as Muslims, as it was for their masters. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Philip, for wonderfully scholarly and variegated presentation. The videos were beautiful. I'm sure there are
a number of questions which the audience would like to ask. Just one preliminary question to get it going. The second video in which you had the large orchestra, this was an example of Maalouf
Al-Ida.
What was the subject or content of that text?
Right. In an oba, you find a mixture of subjects. There isn't one particular subject. So the first part could be, let's say, about the relationship of man and the rapport of man with Allah. And then in the second poem, the relationship of man and woman. And then, more text and more poetry related to wine and intoxication, the use of wine to feel very close to Allah and to God. So in an oba you find different subjects. There isn't one specific subject.
This is fascinating because it suggests to me that in the Naubat you have a fusion of the sacred and the secular. You don't have a sharp distinction. In fact, a multiplication or proliferation of sacred stroke secular themes is encouraged. This is quite makes it a rather unusual genre.
Yeah. In fact, some ask, is the Maalouf sacred music or secular music? It all depends on the context. So if the Maalouf is being performed in Zawiya, that's would be considered as sacred music. But if performed on stage, that would be considered as sacred music. It all depends on the context. Whether it is sacred or secular depends on the context.
To stick to this point about sacred and secular, yes, it does depend on context, but I'm not sure it depends only on the context, that is to say, the frame of performance. You said that the sheikhs of the Qadiriyya and the Arusiyya said that what the Isawiyya performed was not always sacred music. Now, you glossed the word Shabiyya or Shabi, or whatever word, as folk. Yeah. I'm not sure if that was the word they used, Shabi or Shabiyya.
Musica Shabiyya.
Yes.
Folk music.
Which is
basically they were referring, they said Musica Shabiyya, but basically they were referring to secular music.
So I'm not think so that sure.
What they, the, okay, right.
Because it is true that is one connotation.
Right.
But the connotation of Shabi in Libya, especially in the context of a revolution that has emphasized the Shabi, even at the expense, some would say, of the grand religious tradition, Shabi also has a sense of what in Maltese we would call popoline. Now, right. in the discussion of religion, that suggests, therefore, even connotations of superstition or heterodoxy. So it doesn't quite leave the domain of the religious, but rather suggests religion which must be reformed.
Okay.
Now, I'm going into this because when you're talking about the emphasis on the old tradition by the sheikhs themselves, I am not sure to what extent this tradition is being enunciated musically in the context even of a logoretic, in the wider context of a religious reform which occurs periodically, and we are going through a stage now, in the Islamic world, in which the religion of the people must be reformed and brought back closer to orthodoxy. Because that context, I think, would change part of the frame in which you've presented us. I don't want to go on for too long, but I'm curious, because when you were mentioning examples of sheikhs who authored and were very fond of pastiche, Now, you use the word obsession, which usually suggests that someone has a single motive in mind, as though it is what has captivated them. Now, I'm going back to that because you've mentioned people who used to work for the Ottomans, or part of the Ottoman administration, which came to an end in 1911.
Right.
The next example, in chronologically, that you mentioned to us was in post-independence Libya, 1964. In fact, not, I mean, well into the years of the monarchy. What happened in between? I mean, do you have a constant use of pastiche or a flux? I'm asking this because one would need to understand this in the context of nationalism. There was a period of Ottomanism in Libya because it was the last... Anyway, I'll stop there. But the thing is, one needs to historicize perhaps the efforts of which preserving this tradition is a part. To come back to where we started from, it's all contextual and relativistic. Simply from the video that I saw, and even relying on the bits and pieces that I know of these practices in Tripoli, but with a particular prejudice, given the kind of people I used to hang around with, I would say that what is a grand tradition for some of the people performing here would be part of the popular Shabiya tradition for others who would completely look down on any kind of maluf of this kind as pertaining to real Islam.
Yes.
So it's
that also happened in Tunisia, Rania. In the sense, in the maluf of Tunisia, they consider the maluf not as art music, but they consider it as popular music.
Yes, but if one is then going to talk about the context of music, one will see it in this case inflected by wider arguments and narratives of identity and competing notions of past and present. I don't want to hog the conversation. I would be particularly interested, for example, most of the people we saw in the first video clip, the one you took, was of young men.
Right.
There were also about three men, at least within the frame, who were dancing. If I'm not mistaken, the Isawiya has a reputation of being much more lax in its practices than the other two. Even in terms of the kind of performances are more like circus performances, at least as I came across that. But I would be interested to know, since most of the people we saw were young men, whether there is a turnover in the membership, not perhaps in the core membership of Sheikh and disciples, but in terms of the people who give the volume, not in the musical sense, the volume in terms of people, whether these are, for how many generations have they been in Tripoli? What kind of musical soundscape do they bring with them that attracts them here? Because it could be a combination of remembering a different kind of practice, the dhikr, back in the countryside.
Yes.
But in that case, what is remembered
is
a bit different.
We were watching Khadra.
Yes.
And the maluf, a maluf session comes after the dhikr. So all this emotional, all these emotions originate during the dhikr, start during dhikr. Then they continue during the maluf session. So I think that, there is a sense of emotion in the maluf. There is a sense of emotion, but that emotion is consolidated by so many other interrelated processes and factors. Such as the concept of Sama, for instance, where the Sufis they have this mystical kind of listening, in the right place at the right time and in the right company. So this Maalouf and whatever happens to Maalouf and what you are saying, it's not just, you know, it does not happen within the performance itself, but it's interrelated to so many other aspects. As regarding to the what happened in the post-revolutionary period, the Libyan government subsidized the Maalouf, first of all, by setting up the National Music Research Center. But the transformation from the old Maalouf to the modern Maalouf in 1964 was in itself, as I see it, it was anticipating what had to happen in the 1969. John Blackin says that music anticipates social situations or social changes. And personally, as I see it, you know, this Maalouf and this change in the Maalouf from the old to the modern Maalouf in itself was anticipating what was going to happen in the 1969.
Well, depending on how specific you get, but yes, I mean, nationalism was very much in the air by that time, and there were many demonstrations beginning in Tripoli. The costumes chosen by Arabi are in fact nationalist costumes. I mean, the kind of costume that he was wearing,
they weren't like that in 1964, eh? They used to dress differently in 1964, but then they changed to the Libyan Jubba.
Yes, my point.
To please the new administration as well, to please the administration and to gain funding.
Just as, yeah? But...
Support, financial support.
But I'm not sure it was just purely manipulative, not that you're suggesting that. There is a sense in which a narrative does crystallize, because some of the practices you showed us here are also practices which have been encouraged in different ways by the revolutionary government. I mean, for example, the remembering the past into a microphone and narrating in that way is something which is done regularly with people, well, nowadays they're almost all dead, but who fought or so somehow participated in the jihad against the Italians. Mm-hmm. And it is a standardized practice, which does change, however, how memory works.
Right, okay.
But one question there, emerging from Runyer's comments, and Philip's reply, is that I gather Maalouf, we have a complex relationship between those who practice Maalouf and other elements of Islam or Islamic society, and also a complex relationship with the state, because from what you said and from your reply, I gather that this is not subterranean or frowned upon by the state. On the contrary, it is, if you will, supported by the state. Some would say appropriated by the state. But I gather as well that among Muslims, there would be those who support it and those who regard it as almost beyond the pale.
And there would be a full range in between.
Yeah. Any other questions? Any other comments? Which?
Yes. For Peter.
Could you tell us something more about the music?
And now, but consists of an instrumental introduction, an improvised instrumental introduction, a prelude, an instrumental prelude, then a vocal improvisation known as istikhbar. So you've got the istiftah, which is an instrumental improvisation.
By a soloist?
Yes, by a soloist, by the guitar player. Then the vocal improvisations of the sheikh, of the leader, right? And then the first section, because an auba can be divided into two parts. There is a part which is known, the Libyan auba is composed of two parts. The first part is known as musaddar, because the music belongs to ika musaddar, which is a rhythmic pattern for in eight fourths, in a rhythmic pattern in eight fourths. 8 fourths, and gradually the nauba then accelerates to a very, very, very fast pace towards the end, and it changes also the tempo of the music to 8 eighths. And the ika, the rhythmic pattern, then becomes ika barwel. So there is always this gradual increase in speeds in any North African nauba, not just the Libyan nauba.
Well, Dr. Philip Chantar, thank you very much for what has been a really revealing and unusual evening. I think Work in Progress seminars want to see you back again next year, and because of the fascinating discussion with the audience, I think perhaps if you were to just draw on one of the themes which has emerged in tonight's discussion and bring your fabulous ethnographic material to bear just on, for example, the point of memory, for example, how mimesis works, for example, the whole relationship between God, spirit, and embodiment in this music itself. Just to pick up one of these themes, I see several seminars here. I do think the radio audience clearly goes away with the impression that musical ethnography, or the ethnography of listening contexts, is definitely a window into Islamic society or Arabic society or Libyan society. Through music, we see different dimensions to society. So thank you very much, Philip.
Thank you.